There was a fellow who was working with me one time who told about when he was in high school and was a football player, and there was another player on their team who was hearing impaired. And this hearing impaired player had a special hearing aid of some sort, so that he could have obviously hear better. But there was one game that they were playing. Apparently they were an average sort of team. And this hearing impaired player happened to be close to the coach, and the coach heard something and said, "What was that?" And the hearing impaired player said, "Oh, well, you know, it's my hearing aid. It's picking up what they're saying in the huddle there." "Oh, well, you're going to stand right next to me the rest of the game." And so it was that each game, this hearing impaired player would stand right next to the coach, and they were beating teams that were quite good. And they got into the playoffs and continued to win. And they got to the championship game, and the hearing impaired player was ill and could not be at the game. And so their team was soundly defeated. Eavesdropping of that sort is illegal in football. It's not illegal in war. You've heard the phrase, "All's fair in love and war." Well, here is this situation where you want to know what the enemy is going to do, how they're going to attack, the kinds of things that they're going to do, where they're going to be. You might recall that during the Gulf War, General Schwarzkopf happened to leak some misinformation to the press, and the press, he played them like a fiddle. They took that information and ran with it. And so the Red Guard came to defend the place where he had said they were going to be, and he attacked from a different location. Christ is the liturgist of history, as we saw a week ago. He is the one who declares what history is. And that's important for us because, you see, we have information about the enemy that the enemy doesn't have about us. The Lord Jesus Christ, the liturgist of history, is able to tell us what will happen. It's as if we're able to eavesdrop on the enemy and know what they're going to do. And it's important that we use that enemy when we enter into the warfare that Christians have. Remember how Paul wrote to the Ephesians concerning the Christian's armor and how we are to carry out the work of the battle against the kingdom of darkness. Well, Daniel chapter 11, remember chapter 10, talks about Jesus, about the Messiah being the one who is the liturgist of history, the one who is in authority over all of history. He is the Lord of Lords and King of Kings, as we read a few minutes ago in Revelation chapter 17. So now in chapter 11 of Daniel chapter 11, we find God giving to Daniel the history, the things that are going to take place. And in fact, what it takes place in verses 2 through 35 is so clear and accurate that people are pretty much agreed as to what it all refers to. We'll take a look at that, but we'll be looking more particularly towards the end of this chapter. And I will say at the outset that I've gained a great deal of understanding of this through the work of Dr. Rush Dooney. What a blessing that has been. Although I will say I've had to read over what he said many times, And I've even used many times the Merriam-Webster app on my smartphone to understand what he says. And so I do not intend to use words like, I can't even remember how they're pronounced. Apotheosis is one, and so forth. Recrudescence, that's the word that I was thinking of. I don't plan to use those other than to mention that in this sermon. But for our scripture lesson then, let us look at chapter 11 of Daniel. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him. Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. The king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days, she will be handed over together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supported her. One from her family line will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold and carry them off to Egypt. For some years he will leave the king of the north alone. Then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but will retreat to his own country. His sons will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south will march out in rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. Yet he will not remain triumphant, for the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. The violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Then the king of the north will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land and will have power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. But his plans will not succeed or help him. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them, but a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back upon him. After this, he will turn back toward the fortresses of his own country, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. After coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully. And with only a few people, he will rise to power. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him, and he will lose heart. Then he will turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. The king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his fathers. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many peoples and will distribute the land at a price. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and of the riches of Egypt with the Libyans and Nubians in submission. But reports from the east and north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas and the beautiful mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. May God bless to us the reading of this portion of his word. No doubt a difficult portion for us as we read of the various aspects here. And yet this is important for us to have, because Christ is showing us what is to take place. And it's important for us to understand what will happen. Let me give you just a brief outline of the chapter. Beginning with verse 2, you have a period where there is a battle that brings in then the those kingdoms who would be immediately following the Persian Empire. You come to, for example, in verses 3 and 4, to Alexander the Great. And his kingdom is one then that is uprooted. It's one where he has a very rapid conquest. His kingdom is divided. But then beginning with verse 5, you have the embattlement of the Ptolemies of Egypt and the Seleucids from the north in Syria, as they fight over Palestine. They fight over God's people. So when you read about the beautiful land, for example, you're reading about God's people there. And here are these two groups that are in conflict with each other. I'm not going to take time to put names to each of these ones, other than to say we're dealing here with the kings of the south, the Ptolemies in the south, which is a reference to Egypt, and in the north to the Seleucids, as Rushduni and others have pointed out. But then in verse 21 through verse 35, you come to one of the most vile kings of all, who really wasn't a king, and yet he took the rule to himself, and that's Antiochus Epiphanes. And the word Epiphanes has to do with a kind of divinity that he claimed for himself. But many use the word Epimenes for him. Sounds very much like Epiphanes, doesn't it? But it's a very different meaning. The one who is a madman. And we know about Antiochus Epiphanes and the work that he did, how he desecrated the temple, how he did things against the Jews, and you end up with the Maccabees then fighting against him. When you come to the end of verse 35 then, you're coming to the end of the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And I'm sure we could probably have Dr. Weir give us an instruction about what each one of these is. And I thought of writing out what Rushduni has for each of these people that are unnamed but are real people or real kingdoms. He and John Calvin are in agreement when we come to verse 36, that when it talks about the king there, it's really talking about a realm, particularly Rome. So that you have Rome that is being dealt with as you go on from there, and not just Rome, but the whole ideologies and so forth that come from Rome and from various nations as they war against each other. God is teaching Daniel what is going to take place. He is warning his people that there is a responsibility that they have. They're able to eavesdrop in on history as to what is going to take place and to be prepared for it. And so verse 32 is an important verse for us to look at. With flattery he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Let me read that in the New American Standard, especially that last part. The people who know their God will display strength and take action. He's reminding us of our duty to know God, to be with him, to stand firmly in Him, in order that we might deal with these ideologies that would come against us to destroy the people of God. Remember, this is an attempt to deal with Palestine, to deal with God's people. And as we come to the later part of the chapter, who are God's people? Well, we're talking here about the Messianic era. Because as he talks about the last times and so forth, at the time of the end, that's an expression that is used for the time following the time of Messiah, the age in which we are now part of history. Well, there are two competing philosophies or ideologies, you might say, that are at work in this battle that continues. This is a house that is divided against itself, as we think of Genesis 3:15, where God says, I will put enmity between you and the woman. Okay, even there in the kingdom of darkness, there is a division. And God's people would be tested then, first of all, by organism. And I'm using Rush Dooney's term here, organism. You know what an organism is. You are an organism. You know, you have organs. But those organs, you know, heart and liver and pancreas and spleen and so forth, work together along with your muscles and skeleton. They work together so that you are an organism. Any animal is an organism. And the body of Christ is often referred to as an organism because we are united in one body. But this is a different sort of organism. This is an organism in which people claim to be one with God. It's a pantheistic sort of thing. So that the king is one with God. He is the extension of God in the earth. And the people being united to the king then also are an extension of God. Now we've already seen that in the earlier parts of Daniel. You might recall as we went through those first chapters that there was Nebuchadnezzar, who wanted these young men in chapter 1 to eat the king's food because there was to be a union of them with the king and with God so that they are an extension of God. He made the image, you might recall, in chapter 3, and he told everybody they're to bow down and worship that image. And you might recall the humor that's there in all those lists of the peoples that were to come. And the lists of the instruments that were to be used. And the number of times that he continues to say, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it becomes a rather monotonous thing instead of saying, these three men. But you see, it was the image that he had made. This is my image, basically, is what Nebuchadnezzar is saying. And then when we come to chapter 4, we find him boasting, is not this great Babylon which I myself have built? In the next chapter, we have King Belshazzar. And Belshazzar had the same attitude. So that when he took the vessels that had come from the temple in Jerusalem, he was counting himself to be an extension of God, and he wanted those vessels to indicate his authority over the God of Israel. And then in chapter 6, where we have Daniel in the lion's den, there is the petition. No petition is to be made by anyone except from you, King Darius, for the next 30 days. And you see the place of God that he has taken. It is his union then with God, that he is the extension of God. that is prominent in these early kingdoms. But it continues to today. We see this same kind of organism today, this organic relationship with God. And I think we see it most clearly in the Eastern religions, Buddhism and Shintoism, Falun Gong, and various other Eastern religions, in yoga and so forth, where we try to make ourselves one with God. Transcendental meditation was one that was popular a few years ago. Now, some of these might have some really beneficial things to do. Some of the exercises, for example, in yoga. But it's a religion also in which we try to become one with God. And we are often tempted by things of that nature. And so God's people are tested by this organism, this kind of a philosophy. But then there came to be another philosophy that was held. And it's especially pointed out to us in verse 37. It is the philosophy of legalism, that we do everything according to the law. And so it's rule by law, and it's an unbending rule of law. Here are the characteristics then that are found in this legalism. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers, or, well, that will end right there to begin with. He shows no regard for the gods of his fathers. In other words, this is atheism. We forget about all gods. We don't want any of them. The second thing has to do with he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the one desired by women. I think that's probably a poor translation of what is being meant there. For the desire of women, and it has to do with procreation and the whole longing that we would have for one another in marriage. And the third one, and we see this in the organism as well, and the third one has to do with exalting himself above them all. But here it's, instead of just doing away with, or being continuous with God, here it's becoming one who is over them, one who is greater than all of the gods. Alexander was one who demonstrated this. And then Rome later on used the unbending rule of law. Rushduni quotes Plutarch as saying concerning Alexander, and I don't have the quotation in front of me, but that he regarded such things as sleep and the act of generation as signs of mortality that he hated. He hated the thought of his own mortality, and yet God took his life at, I believe it was age 33. Here was one who did not like being human. And he also noted there that he loved the inscription that was on Cyrus's tomb. And again, I don't have the quotation in front of me, but it was basically how he was horrified by the thought of being human. But you see, that's something that follows from atheism. If we don't recognize who God is and how he has made man in his image, then we're going to have no regard for man. We're not going to want who man is. And as we look at our own society, we see that disregard for God that has come out in and been expressed in the disregard for man in And that's why we can abort babies and we can euthanize those who are sick. And we can just kill in mass shootings whoever we want to. There is no regard for God. Legalism has captivated much of Christianity. You realize how many in churches today are requiring various works for us to be saved. That we are somehow to get out of our sin and misery by the things that we do. I happened to be speaking with a man this past week who was upset with the church that he had been raised in, and so he left it as a teenager. He's now a few years older than I am. And he went into the Masons because he liked that. But he had some questions for me about Christianity, and I pointed out to him, well, it's not by the works, by the things that you do, that you have salvation. It's by grace. And I don't think I'll ever forget the question that he asked me right after that. Well, then, how do you earn grace? And of course, I said, that's a contradiction in terms. And he immediately picked up on it and said, oh, it's a gift, huh? Well, how do you get that gift? He wasn't ready to receive it. But you see, he had seen that kind of legalism in the church that he was christened in, and in other churches that he had been a part of or had been in. It's legalism that has affected the church. And these things are going to test us who belong to Jesus Christ. But there's another one that is testing us. And we must stand firmly in Christ, not to be taken in by organism or by legalism or by this other. And what is it? Well, it's mentioned to us in the very last verse, verse 45. Because you see, when you come to verse 36, things are not given in such specific terms as they are in the first 35 verses. Now it's more of a pictorial thing. And when it says he will pitch his royal tents between the seas and the beautiful mountain, or the holy mountain, that's really what it's saying there, between the seas and the holy mountain. Some people have taken that, okay, it's going to be between the Mediterranean Sea and the holy mountain. But the word seas is plural. Think back of what we read in Revelation chapter 7, verse 15. You see, all that evil comes out of the seas. It is representative of the world. Here is one who takes his stand between, figuratively, between the seas and the holy mountain. He doesn't go after the way of the world completely, but yet he doesn't go after the way of God completely. And what that is called is syncretism, where we want to be godly. We want to follow God, but you know, the world has a lot to teach us, so we'll bring that in as well. Back when I was a boy, there was a psychologist who was known as a Christian. And he counseled wives to divorce their husbands if they got in the way of their careers. And it affected some of our congregations in the Reformed Presbyterian Church. He was taking the ways of the world and trying to mesh them with what he saw in the Bible. And he was destroying the church. It's one of those syncretistic things that we have to turn away from. We have to look to Jesus Christ and stand firm in Him. People will use biblical language without the biblical meaning of those words. And we need to be alert to those sorts of things in order that we might stand firmly for Jesus Christ. We also need to recognize that we worship the Creator who is totally distinct from the creature. God, as the Creator, has made all things. And we are not continuous with Him. But when we say that we are in union with Jesus Christ, that does not make us to be sharing in His deity, but in His perfect humanity, as He gives to us His righteousness. And if you have not yet come to be a partaker of the righteousness of Christ, I would plead with you to turn to Him and to seek the mercy that He gives in order that you too might be a partaker of Christ, not between the seas and the holy mountain, but in the holy mountain itself, in the place where God dwells with His people. You bear the image of God. If you belong to Christ, you bear the image of God, and that should satisfy you. It should bring you to live for Him. You also recognize that you are saved by grace, not by law. Not by the works of the law. But the law is something rather that should point you to Jesus Christ in order that you might remain firm in Him. Because the Lord's eye is on those who trust Him. And so Jesus, the liturgist of history, is able to care for you and will provide for you, just as He has warned you of what will happen, so that you might be prepared for the end of the age, for this age in which we live.